Hare Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Okay, so bottom of seven. The desires for acquiring a house, possessing land, having children, becoming prominent in society, the affection for community and the place of birth, and the hankering for wealth, which are all like phantasmagoria or illusory dreams, encumber a human being, and he is thus impeded in his progress towards self-realization, the real aim of life. Right? Does that make sense? So, in other words, what's happening is he's saying here, the desires for lording over the material world under the intoxication of false sense of lordship. Right, because that's the weakness that's there. Specifically began just after the man's unification with the woman. Right, so what are those desires for lording it over? That is acquiring a house, possessing land, having children, becoming prominent in society, right, the affection for community and the place of birth, and the hankering for wealth, which are all like phantasmagoria or illusory dreams. Right, does that make sense? That's just how it works. Even if we see in the general history, you know, the things don't work out, you know, it doesn't, you know, and then the guy is just doing some very out-of-the-way menial work, doesn't care about anything, you know, just does his work really good, but doesn't care about himself, this, that, blah, you know, and so, like that. And then they kind of inspire him in this and that, and then, okay, he goes along, but then once he meets the woman, then he becomes the master of, you know, whatever it is, and leads the revolution and takes over and does everything, right? Yes. So that's just how it works. So it's not, we're not, you know, we can say, no, this is just our viewpoint. What do you mean? Hollywood makes billions out of this point. You know? Yes.
But it seems this is the high end of the wrong, because, like, One sannyasi, he was saying that there are two reasons to go into the grihastha ashram. One is to expand the dynasty, and the other one is sense enjoyment. And this is talking about expanding, you know, the dynasty.
It's the subtle prominence in society. That's the subtle form of it, because that's what's underlying it all. We'll say it's just to expand the family, but the point is once the family's been expanded, then he expects some respect for that. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So the subtle always turns into gross. And gross, and therefore gross can only be there if the subtle is there. Maybe he's unaware of it, you know, but it will, they go together.
What I mean is that it just seems that today many people, at least in the West, they're trying to avoid these principles, and they just want, you know, the benefits that you can get, like the sensual enjoyment, that the sexual interaction, and then, you know, try to avoid all the responsibilities that comes with it.
That's there on one level, but at the same time, is if the guy lives out of his car, how far does he get? Okay. If he has land and all that, it goes a long way, right? Okay, he doesn't have children, that could be a plus. Being prominent in society is that it has its advantages. Affection for community in the place of birth, right? You know, people can relate to that. You know, hankering for wealth, right? Because if he doesn't have that, then there's no question that he'll get any. And then how is he going to impress? You know what I'm saying? So basically, it's there. You just have the point of children may be the only point in question.
Yeah.
Right? But we're talking about children as effect. Yeah. Like that. Okay, footnote 4. In this passage, Srila Prabhupada paraphrases the famous Bhagavatam verse, Srimad Bhagavatam 5.5.8. The attraction between male and female is the basic principle of material existence. On the basis of this misconception, which ties together the hearts of the male and female, one becomes attracted to his body, home, property, children, relatives, and wealth. In this way, one increases life's illusions and thinks in terms of I and mine. For the brahmacharya, you're a boy from the age of 5 years, especially from the higher castes, namely from the scholarly parents, the brahmanas, the administrative parents, the kshatriyas, and the mercantile or productive parents, the vaishyas, is trained until 25 years of age under the care of a bona fide guru or teacher. And under strict observance of discipline, he comes to understand the values of life, along with taking specific training for a livelihood. Right? So the point is he gets the strict observance of discipline, he comes to understand the values of life, and then along with taking strict specific training for a livelihood. Right? So that comes along with it. But the point is learning the values of life. So therefore, with the discipline, he learns the values of life. Then he can apply an occupation. The brahmachari is then allowed to go home and enter householder life and get married to a suitable woman. Right? Not just anyone, but one who matches. Because you have to have a match. They have to be able to work together. Right? Like that. Okay. Yeah. But there are many brahmacharis who do not go home to become householders, but continue the life of naishtika brahmacharis without any connection with women. They accept the order of sannyas, or the renounced order of life, knowing well that combination with women is an unnecessary burden that checks self-realization. Since sex desire is very strong at a certain stage of life, the guru may allow the brahmachari to marry. This license is given to a brahmachari who is unable to continue the way of naistika brahmacharya. Right? So as naistika, it doesn't mean that he's not a good brahmachari. He's trained, right? Because that's the whole thing. He's been trained, so he understands the values of life and has the knowledge for livelihood. Right? And such discriminations are possible for the bona fide guru. A program of so-called family planning is needed. So now is it a program of so-called family planning? You know, in other words, a program of planning is needed. A program of so-called family, or is it a program of so-called family planning is needed? Or?
I think the last one.
Okay. The householder who associates with woman under scriptural restrictions after a thorough training of brahmacharya cannot be a householder like cats and dogs. Such a householder, after 50 years of age, would retire from the association of women as a vanaprastha, to be trained to live alone without the association of women. When the practice is complete, the same retired householder becomes a sannyasi, strictly separate from women, even from his married wife. Studying the whole scheme of disassociation with women, it appears that a woman is a stumbling block for self-realization, and the Lord appeared as Narayana to teach the principle of womanly disassociation with a vow in life. Right? Because we're talking about Narayana Rishi. Right? So they took this position. The demigods, being envious of the austere life of the rigid brahmacharis, would try to cause them to break their vows by dispatching soldiers of Cupid. But in the case of the Lord, it became an unsuccessful attempt. When the celestial beauties saw that the Lord can produce innumerable such beauties by his mystic internal potency, and that there was consequently no need to be attracted by others externally. But just for his internal potency, he could create all these beautiful girls himself. So he didn't need to become attracted by the external beauty of these upstarts. Right? So then that just kind of naturally, you know, they say, in these, as soldiers of Cupid, the women are smart, so they know what battle plan is going to work and what's not, right? You know, so others might, you know, the men might not understand, but the women understand. Says, no, this guy's already. He makes his own women that are better than us, so he doesn't. He's not going to be attracted by us, right? But in the case of the Lord, it became an unsuccessful attempt. when the celestial beauty... Oh, okay. There is a common proverb that a confectioner is never attracted by sweetmeats. The confectioner, who is always manufacturing sweetmeats, has very little desire to eat them. Similarly, the Lord, by his pleasure potency, by his pleasure potential powers, can produce innumerable spiritual beauties and not to be the least attracted by the false beauties of material creation. Because the spiritual beauties will attract because of devotion, but the material beauties aren't using devotion. One who does not know alleges foolishly that Lord Krishna enjoyed women in his Rasa Leela in Vrindavan, or with his 16,000 married wives at Dwarka. So they don't understand the devotional element is there. So he's just reciprocating and acting on that platform. So he's beyond the attraction that I think I'm going to enjoy the nature of woman. Right? For Krishna, it's reciprocating the devotion that comes in that in the interaction. Does that make sense? It's not about. It's not that the interaction is what is interesting. It's the devotion. So interaction is only the medium to carry the devotion. Yes. Some very accomplished mystics, among them Shiva as foremost, are able to vanquish Kamadev by their wrathful glances. But such great yogis are helpless against the onslaught of reaction that the release of such terrible anger generates. Right? So in other words, they may be able to vanquish Kamadev by the wrathful glances, but then the reaction from that wrath, then that they have problem dealing with. Like that. So it doesn't always work out. That's why it said is that the yogi, he does all this, he becomes very powerful, and then he loses it all in anger.
Was there some specific reaction that Shiva got for burning?
That I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Just he had to come again as born as the son of Krishna. Mm-hmm. Brahma points out that the Lord's mind cannot be penetrated by anger. How then, he asks, can his heart be penetrated by lust? Right? Because those who control lust, they're controlled by anger. Right? And he's not controlled by anger, so that puts him even beyond that. So that's why I said if you can control anger, then you can control. Because what's anger? Anger after frustration. Things don't go the way you want. Srila Prabhupada explains. When Lord Shiva was engaged in severe austere meditation, Cupid, the demigod of lust, threw his arrows of sex desire. Lord Shiva, thus being angry at him, glanced at Cupid in great wrath, and at once the body of Cupid was annihilated. Although Lord Shiva was so powerful, he was unable to get free from the effects of such wrath. But in the behavior of Lord Vishnu, there is no incident of such wrath at any time. On the contrary, Bhrigu Muni tested the tolerance of the Lord by purposely kicking his chest. But instead of being angry at Bhrigu Muni, the Lord begged his pardon, saying that Bhrigu Muni's leg might have been badly hurt because his chest is so hard. The Lord has the sign of the foot of Bhrigupada as the mark of tolerance. Right? So it's yeah. The Lord, therefore, is never affected by any kind of wrath. So how can there be any place for lust, which is less strong than wrath? When lust or desire is not fulfilled, there is the appearance of wrath. But in the absence of wrath, how can there be any place for lust? Right? Because wrath is more powerful. Lord Brahma continued. The small prince Dhruva entered the forest to perform the severest austerities after being insulted by his co-mother, Suruchi, in the presence of his father. His birth mother, Suniti, advised him to seek out the Lord where the sages find him, in the forest of austerities. By the mercy of Narad Muni, Dhruva Maharaj received initiation into transcendental knowledge, austerity, and chanting of the Lord's holy name. Only 6 months later, young Dhruva was more powerful than the host of demigods, who begged the Lord to oblige the boy to cease his austerities. That means very focused. Right? So the whole point is It's because it's not about age, it's about the focus. So he was so focused that even at 6 years old, in 6 months, he had generated the power of all the demigods together. So therefore, then they went to the Lord and asked that he do something. The whole creation was choked for breath on them. The Lord in his Prishnagarbha avatar form awarded the boy the planet Dhruva, which means imperishable. Visible in the night sky as Polaris, Dhruva Loka is actually Vaikuntha planet, the abode of Kiradakshai Vishnu. 8. Descending in this world as the son of King Vena, the Prithu avatar delivered his cruelly arrogant father from hell, where he had been sent by the curse of the Brahmanas. Footnote 5. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains. It is described in the Vamana Purana that Prithu heard from Narada that his father, whose powers had been burnt up by the thunderbolt curse of the Brahmanas, after suffering in hell, had attained the low body of a leper. Prithu brought him to Prithu Lake. I'm saying Prithu brought him to Prithu. Okay. Prithu brought him to Prithu Lake at Kurukshetra, and by bathing him there, delivered him from his unremitting suffering. After that, he milked the earth for food and other items. Like that. So, yeah. So that's Putra. Saves the father.
Was that from some location on earth that he was, you know, a leper?
It seems to be.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're getting... After suffering in hell, had attained the low body of a leper.
Yeah.
Like that. So now Prithu brought him to Prithu Lake at Kurukshetra. So he must have been somewhere here. Prithu Maharaj performed a great sacrifice by which the earth yielded up all kinds of desirables for the different grades of living entities under Prithu's rule. 9. In his purport to this verse, Srila Prabhupada explains that according to the system of Varnashram Dharma, Brahmanas are the natural guardians of society. The Brahmanas, by their learned labor of love, would instruct the administrator kings how to rule the country in complete righteousness, and thus the process would go on as a perfect welfare state. The kings, right, so a perfect welfare state, not just a welfare state, because it's a welfare state in that all the citizens are being protected so everything can develop nicely. But it's not a welfare state in that the government is just taxing those who are working and then taking care of those who are not. Right? You know, so that's why it's a perfect welfare state. Because everyone's protected, therefore everybody has an occupation. And so if there's anybody who doesn't, that's because they can't. And so then they're taken care of. So that's minimal. Right? That's less of it. That's, or let's say, less. The kings or the Kshatriya administrators would always consult the council of learned Brahmins. They were never autocratic monarchs. The scriptures like Manu Samhita and other authorized books of the great sages were guiding principles for ruling the subjects, and there was no need for less intelligent persons to manufacture a code of law in the name of democracy. Right? So, then why less intelligent? It means because they're not able to see the Lord, not able to see a connection. So they're seeing that there's problems with an autocratic state. And because of this, the weaknesses in there, they try to address those. But what are the strengths in the state that they're neglecting? So then you weaken the state by making the people more powerful. But the point is if the state becomes weak, how does it protect the people? And then you don't actually solve the problem. You don't really solve the problem, because as long as things are peaceful, then it appears to be working wonderfully.
But as soon as there's any threat to the security of the nation, then the state has to take on positions of security that greatly restrict the freedoms of the individual. So that means, even though one has come up with all these nice democratic elements, one has not actually addressed the position of, you know, how autocracy works, how governance works. Does that make sense? So one can say, no, but the democracy, but the point is if the democracy is not threatened, it appears that it works nicely as the democracy you hope it would be. But as soon as it's threatened, its existence, it stops working like one and goes right back to the autocratic position that that they try to make rulings against and come up with democracy, you know, thousands of years before. It automatically goes back to that. That's just the nature of it. So then what does it mean? The state is supposed to be protecting and taking care of the people, because that's the common thing between the two, right? If there's more freedoms, it still has to be an environment of protection. If there's less freedoms, it's for the protection of the people. So protection is the common element, not freedom. Because freedom can only be there at certain times. Just like even in the Romans, which were working under, you know, more of a oligarchy and, you know, things, a little bit more of that kind of democratic element. Not as much, I think, as the Greeks. But so then, in their functioning, everything was more open as long as there was no war. But if there was war, then they would actually, for 6 months, elect a dictator so that everything would go exactly, because you can't have bureaucracy getting in the way of making decisions when there's a war. So even they understood, you know, that you had to do these things. So you always have this. So that's the point, is the Vedic, then, whether it's peace or whether it's war, then the administration is working under the direction of the Brahmins. Then it can keep balanced. Then, based on the religious principles, one can make it work. Otherwise, then, it's just going to keep changing as the modes are there, and then people will wonder what happened. But here, then, there's consistency. Right, so that means, because less intelligent means not seeing the Lord. So you see it connects with the Lord, then you can operate this more intelligent system. Right? Because it's not by mundane intelligence like that. It's by spiritual intelligence. The material intelligence is useful as a skill, but it's not the ultimate determining factor. The less intelligent mass of people have very little knowledge of their own welfare. Right, because even you say it's about the people, but the people, what should they do? What are they supposed to do? You know, what's right? The people, like you have America, you have 50 states. Each state actually can, on certain things that aren't controlled by central government, can make their own laws. What age you can get married? What age you can start drinking alcohol? What are different things like that? Whether there's gay marriage or not, whether there's abortion or not, it's up to them. That's a democracy. Then you make the thing, no, everybody has to be like that. You know, we have to make all states have to have no abortion, or all of them have to have, you know. How is that democracy? So these individuals in the name of democracy are actually propounding a non-democracy by saying, no, everybody has to have this, because if you don't have it, that's not democracy. No, but democracy means what the people want. And so in that state, those people voted, and they didn't want something. You know, so that's the point, is that the mass of people don't really know what's good for them. And then the problem is these so-called intelligent people, then they don't actually know the whole picture. So even what they come up with solves one problem but doesn't address another. Right? So then it's a difficult.
Well, You mentioned before that material intelligence is a skill. Is material intelligence useful for varna and spiritual intelligence asa? Is there some correlation like that?
It means there's basically, but what we're saying is that if you add the material intelligence of the skill to the spiritual, then it's just like this. Let's say the administrator isn't so founded in the spiritual, but if they're willing to listen to those who are, then their great material ability in, let's say, governance is useful. But if it doesn't have that direction, then that lack of seeing the whole picture, there'll always be some mistake. Right? And so to solve those mistakes, you create bureaucracy, which slows things down so no one can get too much power in any too quickly. The whole thing is geared that no one should get too much power. Sure. You know, if it's all about the people, it means the people elected one president four times in a row. So one should be happy. The people like the guy, they elected him. You know, so what if it keeps going? But then people are worried, well, it'll turn into a dictatorship, so they got rid of it. So you saw that in Rome. It was always coming up. But all the rules put into place couldn't keep it from turning into, right? They thought, what's his name? Caesar had too much power. But Caesar was willing to work with everybody. He just wanted it controlled. That, you know, if you're a senator, do something, not just sit around. You know, the people are there, all these kind of things. So they thought, this guy's cramping our style. They killed him. So who did they get? They got Augustus. And Augustus came in and every last one of them chased them all over the Roman Empire until he found them and killed them all. You know, because his point was, is that's not how you're supposed to behave as a senator. You don't kill, you know, what's the head guy called?
It was the emperor.
Caesar. The emperor, but there was a name, something with a C or something.
Caesar,
but there was some, whatever. So, but you know what I'm saying. He was elected. He sat in the chair that sits down in the middle of the floor. Right? You don't kill this guy and then say you're government. You know, that's treason. So he killed them all. So now, which would have been better? Caesar not being killed or killing him and getting the reaction, Augustus? So that's the whole point. Or, you know, for the people, yes, get rid of the czar, you know, and then you get Stalin. You know? He also liked the people, right? As long as they were in, you know, Siberia. Plenty of opportunity.
Fresh air.
Yeah, fresh air. Yeah. Okay. So does that make sense? So in other words, all these are arrangements by this immature intelligence has never actually solved anything. Right? It appears just like, you know, you externally make it look nice, but underneath it doesn't. What's the difference?
It's a facade.
It's a facade, yeah. Like that. The less intelligent mass of people have very little knowledge of their own welfare, right? As a child has very little knowledge of its future well-being. The experienced father guides the innocent child towards the path of progress. And the childlike mass of people needs similar guidance. The standard welfare codes are already there in the Manu Samhita and other Vedic literatures. The learned Brahmins would advise the king in terms of these standard books of knowledge and with reference to the particular situation of time and place. Right? Because others say, oh, but that's, you know, that doesn't apply to, nobody's saying, time and place. Such Brahmanas were not paid servants of the king. And therefore, they had the strength to dictate to the king on the principles of scripture. Because the king's not taking care of them, they're independent. So when we say independent, we mean independent. But, this system continued even up to the time of Maharaj Chandragupta, and the Brahmana Chanakya was his unpaid prime minister. Right, because he lived in his own hut, he would go out begging and maintain himself. And that way he had the position to tell the king what to do. Because otherwise, what was the problem with that Bhishma mentioned? Bhishma, Drona, Kripa. Because they were taken care of by the king. Therefore, they were contaminated by that being taken care of. In other words, he gets a sixth of their benefit and they get the part of, you know, the consciousness. So they were affected by that. So they couldn't make the right decisions. So that's why he says that this class of Brahmins, they're not taken care of by the king. He may give them charity and all that, but that's his business. But he doesn't regularly take care. It's a weak position. You do have examples where they do, and it works nicely. But we can see is that, you know, Chanakya was the example of that. If you really want to have authority, you have to be independent. Yes.
It seems that in the case of Bhishma, it was not that he couldn't discriminate properly, but he just felt obliged.
You have that element also, but at the same time, as the grand sire, he could have been taken a stronger stand. But the point is ultimately we know is that this is all the arrangement of the Lord for the pastime. Because if he had taken a stronger stand, then, you know, Duryodhana wouldn't have had the power. You wouldn't have been able to bring together all the demoniac mentalities of the world into one place and get rid of them in 18 days. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, and then you do it in a great way, and people will talk about it. So one's always remembering the Lord. So there is that element of the Lord's pastime. You know, so that's why it works out that way. So him being an illusion is like Arjuna being an illusion so that you could hear Bhagavad Gita.
Probably also was spoken of earlier.
Yes, but at the same time is he is following the principle of religion that he's supporting, he's taking care, he's supposed to take care of the king and work it out. He's supposed to support the king. That was his duty.
Yeah.
Right? Like that. So whoever was in the seat, then he would support. Lord Rishabdev appeared as the son of Nabi Maharaj and Queen Sudevi. Although he is the supreme Yogeshwara, master of all mystics, Rishabdev practiced Jara Yoga, a materialistic means of gaining equilibrium of mind by self-abnegation. He thus taught the common people the meaning of Prasanta Karana, control of the senses. In his own transcendental person, he displayed in full the characteristics of a liberated soul. Right, so he's showing this principle of just control of the senses through basically just not addressing them, or addressing them to the minimal. You know, so it sets a standard. But misunderstanding that's how you get the whole Jain religion that comes from it. Mahavirya?
Yes.
Like Mahavirya? Yeah. He saw Rishabdev. And so then he then took that and then started his what he thought was that practice of Jhana Yoga. But he didn't see it in connection with the Lord, so he was following an impersonal path.
So it was
just
Jhana.
Huh?
Just Jhana.
Yeah. Yeah, no yoga. Yes. Brahma remembers the sacrifice he performed at which the Hayagriva avatar appeared. This form of the Lord is golden and exhibits the head of a horse upon the body of a person. Lord Hayagriva is the personification of all Vedic scriptures and yajnas as Devatma. He guides the demigods from within their hearts. The sweet sound of the Vedas emanates from his nostrils as he breathes. Yeah, so that's why you have that element of the nostalgia of when the horses, you know, they make that sound with their nose. Because when the Lord does that, then it's all the Vedas. You know, or the flapping of the bird's wings, because then Garuda, it's all the Vedas.
The Lord is quite humoristic when he's choosing those forms, because the personified yajnas is a boar and the personified Vedas, that's a horse. It's like,
yeah. I mean, there must be some, behind that there'll be some reason,
yeah.
You know, why that works out that way. And some Purana somewhere will have a verse that mentions that. But basically it's just, he likes it that way. And he likes what's perfect. What he likes is already perfect. So everything he does, so you can take it scientifically back or tantrically back into its detail, but it's that comes because all it is defining, you know, why the Lord did it. But the Lord did it because it pleases him, and he only does things that are auspicious. So it's going to be good. If the Lord's done it, you can be satisfied that everything's good. You know, just like, you know, is that if he's a friend of yours, he's a friend of mine, right? You know, so it means you're a good friend, so I trust you, so therefore if you think he's a friend, then he'll not be my friend. So therefore, if the Lord's done it, it must be good, so we're happy.
Next, Brahma remembers when the Vedas fell from his mouth due to his fear of the rise of the waters of devastation in the period of his night. The Lord incarnates as the greatest of fishes, Matsyavatar, to save the Shrutis and to benedict his devotee, King Satyavrata, who later became the Vaivasvata Manu. 12. In his Krishna Sandarbha, Srila Jiva Goswami refers to verse 12 to establish that Matsyavatara is accepted by authorities as a prominent incarnation of Godhead. Matsyavatara is one of the Dasavatars. Ordinary fish are among the lowest of creatures, but prominent incarnations of the Lord, even in the shape of a fish, boar, or hybrid of two species, forms like Lord Nrisimhadev and Hayagriva, are never inauspicious. Their glorious nature, so even hybrids are an original Vedic concept. Their glorious nature is self-evident, for whomever chants their holy names, qualities, and pastimes is delivered. That is why Brahma drew Narada's attention to the Lord's appearance as the original, transcendental, all-auspicious fish. So again, you were saying here about the Lord of the Yajna and then the personification of all Vedic scriptures. Then when Brahma, you know, when the Vedas fall from his mouth due to fear, then as a fish, he saves them. Right? Because it fell into the water. So then naturally, who's going to save them? Right? Fish. Right? That's how it works. When Brahma recites the appearance of Kurma Avatar, when the demigods and demons had a contest to produce nectar from the milk ocean, they set Mandara Parvat upon the surface of the ocean as the churning rod. Vasuki, his coils wrapped around the mountain, was the rope for churning the rod. But because the mountain had no support beneath its base, save the milk, it sank and disappeared. Right? In other words, our endeavors without support, then they just don't disappear. They don't have any meaning. Because you see, everybody in the world does activities. Everybody's done great things. Where are they now? Right? Okay. They're standing there, you know, how you say, immortalized in, you know, what is it, Madame Tussauds, you know, museum. but otherwise, who cares? You know, unless they're on internet, who cares, really? So then the whole point is why? Because there's no foundation in the Lord. But now we see these personalities that their foundation was with the Lord, people remember. Arjuna, Yudhishthira, you know, Nard Muni, the Kumar, means all these personalities. It's remembered because it's connected to the Lord. They remember the Lord and those devotees and their activities connected to the Lord. But if it's not connected to the Lord, it will be soon forgotten, just like everything else. But rose again upon the back of the gigantic tortoise incarnation. Now it has a foundation, right, on the Lord, who accepted the churning as a way to have his back scratched. Right? So then they're doing service. So even though that, you know, they're trying to get the nectar, but he accepts it as service because the process of churning the ocean to get the nectar scratches his back. So the Lord is very kind that he himself finds ways in which we can take our material desires and connect them to the Lord. You know. In his purport to this verse, Srila Prabhupada stresses the importance of the seeing all these pastimes through the pages of authentic books of knowledge, Shastra Chakshurvat. So we cannot deny the existence of the ocean of milk, as stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, unless and until we have experimentally seen all the planets. Hovering in the space. Since such an experiment is not possible, naturally we have to accept the statement of Srimad Bhagavatam as it is. because it is so accepted by spiritual leaders like Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti, and others. The Vedic process is to follow in the footsteps of great authorities, and that is the only process for knowing that which is beyond our imagination. Because otherwise, if you're saying, okay, science is based on what you can see, but how much of science has the individual seen who has faith in science? Right? Very little. You know, it's probably, you know, in the, you know, thousandth or ten thousandth of a percent or something, you know. Has anybody ever seen inside a internal combustion engine when the actual explosion takes place? Have they seen it? Right. You know, when was the last time you were inside? Right? You know, so that means it's basically, so it's, you have to go on authority. Does that make sense? There's all these things, it's based on authority. So we have our authority. Yes. Faith and authority. That's the principle. So all it is saying is we have faith in our authorities, not in yours. But the point is these authorities then have faith in the Supreme Absolute Truth. Right? And you see, by following what they do, you get an innate spiritual benefit, an eternal benefit. While the other ones, you follow what the others say, and it doesn't necessarily work out so great.
Materially or spiritually?
Yeah, because otherwise, if it was better, why isn't it getting better? Right? You know, we're so worried about pollution, but there's more stuff to pollute than there was before. What was pollution before? You know, the guy, you know, how you say, cooking his wild boar, you know, over his, you know, the fire out in the, you know, under the trees. You know, what else was there? So how is it now? Now you have unlimited amounts of plastic, and you can't even throw the batteries away or this or that. You know, they say don't. You have to have a special place to put them. Right. So all these things is that we say it's improved, but how is it improved? You know, we're talking about natural, but you know, every day they invent something new that's not natural. Because if it's natural, it doesn't need invention. Okay, the Vedic process is to follow in the footsteps of great authorities, and that is the only process for knowing that which is beyond our imagination. In his half-man, half-lion form of Lord Nrisimhadev, the Lord placed the demon Hiranyakashipu upon his lap to shred his body with his nails while fiercely rolling his eyes and baring his frightful fangs. By this wonderful pastime, the Lord vanquished the demigods' helpless fear of this most mighty among the asuras. Even though his body was that of an elephant, Gajendra remembered how to call out to the Lord for protection when his leg was seized by the jaws of a crocodile. As he chanted the glories of the Lord, he offered him a lotus flower held in the coil of his trunk. The Lord rode out of Vaikuntha on Garuda's back to answer his devotee's plea. He delivered the crocodile with his chakra and lifted Gajendra up by his trunk. Right, so that's the point. He's impartial. He saved both of them. You know, one using a chakra and one lifting him up by his trunk. But here is, he remembered, even though he was an elephant. Say elephant, we say elephant, it's elephant, we say elephant. So he made the point, the purport that this chanting, that therefore the regular chanting of hymns, of the Hare Krishna mantra, Brahma Samhita, you know, different prayers and that then even if one is in an unfortunate situation like this as an elephant, then one can remember the Lord because they're just so practiced that they just naturally come up in the consciousness. Because it wasn't as an elephant he had been, you know, had gone to school and learned these prayers, you know, or we don't hear that he was hanging around in the ashrams of the sages and thereby he learned the prayers.
He was just the king of the elephants, and he was just enjoying himself as the king of the elephants. Elephants, yes. And so in his last life, as Indradumna, there he had known, he knew these prayers. And so then they came up. There is a great love for the Vamana avatar in the heavenly kingdom of the demigods. Vamana blessed Aditi Devi, mother of the Aditya Devatas, by taking birth from her womb as her youngest son. It is quite natural for the youngest son to become the pet of the whole family. If that child is an avatar of the all-attractive Bhagavan, Sri Krishna, parental vatsalya sentiment on the part of his devotees is perfectly in order. Right? So here getting attached to a family member is not bad. So as long as, you know, one of your family members, or the member of the family you're getting attached to, if they're an incarnation of the Supreme Lord, then don't worry about it. It's okay. Lord Vamanadeva appears as an undersized brahmachari of precocious yet guileless demeanor. Right? So he's, you know, he precocious, he's very active and all that, but at the same time a guileless, that there's no, how you say, what would that be, improper?
No attitude
of pride. Yeah, no pride, no self-centered like this. It's always for benefit. But he'll be very bold in what he does. Right? This form of the Supreme is so disarming that even the powerful king of the demons, Bali Maharaj, refused to heed his guru Shukracharya's warning that the mission of Vamanadeva is to restore the authority and opulence of the demigods. Right? Since time immemorial, the Asuras have been in rebellion against the Adhidaiva principle of divine authority over creation. Usually, the demigods are able to restrict the demons from extending their anarchic influence outside of the nether regions of darkness, where Brahma ordered they remain. Footnote 7. Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur comments. The elephant... No, that's 6. Where was that 6? Oh, there it was. I didn't see it there. Okay, I'll just read them both. The elephant calls out 4 names of the Lord. Quote, "You possess a human form from the beginning, Adi Purusha. But I, because of being a jiva, had a human form previously, but now have an elephant form. You are the master of all people, Akila Loka Natha. You can also be my master. You are famous for purifying, Tirtha Shrava. And therefore you should purify me of the sin of this low birth. I have heard your auspicious name, Shravana Mangala, from the mouth of my guru. Now, how then can I be in this inauspicious position now?" Okay. 7. Before the assumptions of reductionism invaded the Western mind. Oh, okay, I was going to say, this must be Sahota Maharaj. This is just the opening. It's just an opening statement. Before the assumptions of reductionism invaded the Western mind, whatever existed in the universe was understood to be irreductibly good or evil. Right? I mean, it has a nature of its proper or its improper. Right? Early New Testament theologians used the term arche, Greek, or principium, Latin, to designate the order by which every created being was assigned a place on one side or other of a cosmic moral background. On one hand was God's own hierarchy of seraphim, cherubim, virtues, powers, archangel, etc. The word heros means holy. Thus a hierarchy is a holy order. Satan and his demons, the fallen angels, were in anarchy or defiance of arche. In other words, Satan was pitted against God's rule. The prefix "an" in the word anarchy means against, and "archos" means ruler, right? Because arche meant the principle of what's right and wrong. The mass of humanity was divided between the hierarchy of God and the anarchy of Satan. Dimensions of good and evil, Sahotra Swami.
Where is that? Oh, just pointing out is that there, that's just the way it's always been. So previously it was even understood that that was there, but until reductionism came in, and then it's, well, then they try to make everything, what do you call it? In comparative to the other thing?
Relative.
Yeah, relative. You know, like the, like in class, basically everyone fails, so therefore you make a list of what they did, and then you just lower the bar down to there, that the guy who did the top and that got the A, and everybody else then, you know, was below that, even though technically they all failed. So that's mm-hmm. that's the benefits of reductionism. Okay. But Bali had gotten the upper hand this time by being a better disciple of Sukracharya than the heavenly king Indra had been of his Gurudev, Brihaspati. So therefore he was technically following the Lord's system. But his usage of it was improper, because he should just be better in doing what he does. But he's trying to take over Indra's position. So even if you have the blessing of Guru, you don't take over someone else's position. Better to do your work nicely. That's why it had to be corrected. Right? So if he was doing, it was more prosperous and everything was going more nicely on the lower heavenly planets by Bali Maharaja's following his guru's order, then why would there be a problem? But because he wanted to extend that, therefore, to the heavenly planets, then there's a problem. Blessed by his guru's Brahma Tejas, brahminical power, King Bali and his army of Asuras wrenched the cosmic management administration away from the demigods. But might does not make right. The triumph of the demons was a triumph of tamagun over sattvagun. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.23 states, Stit yadye hari virinchi hareti samgya shrayamsi tatra kalu sattva tanor nirinam suhu. For the purpose of creation, maintenance, and destruction, the Supreme Lord accepts all three modes. Of the three, goodness is meant to be cultivated by human beings who are desirous about achieving the goal of life, liberation in God consciousness. End quote. Hari, the Lord who mercifully steals away our material attachments, appeared as the Vamana avatar to beg from Bali Maharaj the charity of quote-unquote just three steps of land. Though Sukracharya threatened to curse his disciple, Bali consented. With just two of his steps, Lord Vamanadeva covered all the planets Bali had conquered. In the end, after the demigods were restored, Bali was not bereft. He purchased the undying protection of the Lord by never veering from his promise. Right, so he stuck to what was appropriate and right. So because he supported the Lord, therefore then he always had the Lord's protection. So even though he lost all the heavenly planets, everything, but there he gained the Lord. Right? So we see is Mahavishnu is beyond the whole creation. Why just one universe? And here he's just talking about parts of the universe. It's not that he went in and conquered all the hellish planets or something. No, he just is the heavenly planets. You know, who cares about in between? But Brahmadev offers praise to the swan incarnation of Godhead, Lord Hamsa. He reminds Narada that he, the Devarshi, personally received instructions in spiritual science from the lotus mouth of Hamsa Avatar. The Lord was much satisfied by the devotional service Narada so faithfully rendered. So Narada heard from the Hamsa Avatar. In his purport to this verse, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that these instructions in spiritual science may be divided into two sections. There are two types of knowledge, one that has Krishna, who is the object of devotion, as the subject, and two, that which has the jiva, who is the shelter of bhakti, as the subject. These are defined by two descriptive terms in the verse. Bhagavatam refers to information for understanding about the Lord's beauty, fragrance, voice, young age, sweetness, and attractive qualities in order to attain prema. The other type is that which removes the covering of ignorance and reveals pradipam, the nature of the jiva, such as knowledge and bliss, who is the shelter of bhakti. These are the two types of knowledge. The pure devotees joyfully understand this knowledge.
So there's knowledge about the Lord, so you're attracted to the Lord, and there's a knowledge about how the jiva is entangled. So the point is one doesn't neglect the knowledge about how the jiva is entangled in to focus on those things about the Lord that are attractive. Because the point is if you're in ignorance, how will you fully appreciate? So therefore, he's saying here, the pure devotees joyfully understand this knowledge means both aspects. So whichever one is coming up, whichever one is the appropriate thing for the position, that's what he's absorbed in.
Sahajas will ignore one and
the Mayavadis will ignore the other, yes. So that's why we're saying bhakti is in the middle.
What does it mean that the jiva is
a little louder?
What does it mean that the jiva is the shelter of bhakti?
Because he's the shelter of bhakti because he has the particular mood of devotion that the Lord reciprocates. So Krishna is the vishaya, the enjoyer. And the devotee is the ashraya, the shelter of this bhakti. Like Mother Jashoda is the ashraya of parental rasa. And Krishna reciprocates with that by being her son.
Does that make sense?
So the point is yes, that's what we're trying to get to. But the point is who's the one getting there? Krishna, does Krishna have the problem of having developed prema? No, he is prema. Right? Does he have a problem of developing rasa? He is rasa. Right? So, who's the one that's got the problem? The conditioned jiva. Right? Therefore, we're talking about, oh, but we're having to listen to all these things, but where does that end? Where does it culminate? It culminates in the jiva being able to take the position of ashra in rasa. Right? Because in the vichar, I mean not vichar, vibhava. Right, within the process of bhava. The vibhava aspect means the Lord as a vishai and the devotee as ashra. Right? You have that principle, which is and that will be based on your stai bhava. Right? So now that being activated by seeing something, the Lord, or something connected to the Lord. Therefore, it produces a emotional response in the devotee. And the Lord reciprocates with that. Right? Because of that, then you get the Anubhav Sanchari Bhavas and Sattvika Bhavas. Right? And then those just further nourish the position of the jiva. I mean, of the stai bhava, or the fixed relationship the Lord, the jiva has with the Lord. In his purport to the same verse, Srila Prabhupada refers to these two types of knowledge as preliminary knowledge of the nature of devotional service and the secondary knowledge of its execution. So here, preliminary and secondary, so the secondary will be the more advanced, but it's based on the preliminary. Because you have to know the nature, and then you can get into the how to execute it. So that means that the Samanya Bhakti, it was preliminary knowledge of the nature of devotional service, the first five chapters, they give Samanya Bhakti. What is the nature of bhakti? For right from the beginning, from Shraddha up to Prema. Right? And so then having define that, then from the sixth chapter, then he gives the principles on which now you're going to practice. Right? You could also say it's preliminary and secondary, being that the secondary is based on this preliminary. You know, if you're looking at it from that way.
Could you also say sadhana and sadhya?
Yes. But in that you're defining the devotional service, so you have to also define the sadhaka. Because otherwise it's the jiva that has the problem. Right? Technically the Lord, he's not the one with the difficulty. We're the one with the difficulty. So that's why you have to explain about the jiva and how he frees himself. But having freed himself, then how what does he do on the other side? Right. So you have two parts of the knowledge about the position of the jiva. Then you have the Supreme Lord himself, who is the object of that. Or you could say the subject of that. He's the object of worship, you could say, but he's the actual subject matter. Because we can say, no, Krishna is the supreme object, but he's not. Just like, is Vishnu the supreme cause? No. Krishna is the cause of all causes. So that puts Krishna as the supreme cause. So we can say, Krishna, he is the object. My love, my affection is that Krishna. So he's the supreme object. But where is his affection focused? On Radharani. Therefore, she's the supreme object. He's the supreme subject. Because we talk about it, Radharani talks about it. Right? Does that make sense? So he's the supreme subject. But the object of worship, even when we worship him, it's to assist him in his worship of Radharani. So to do that, you take the position as servant of God.
So here, this secondary knowledge of its execution, it refers to the understanding of the Lord's beauty, fragrance. Lord.
Yeah, just the process. How to hear, chant, remember about the name, form, qualities, and pastimes of the Lord. But the preliminary, you must know who you are, what is devotional service, what's material, what's spiritual. Well, the Lord accepted the Manu dynasty as his own, thus incarnating to take command over the miscreant kings of the world. Taking up his most powerful weapon, Sudarshana Chakra, he cut and burnt the crooked-minded leaders who misused their positions in defiance of Dharma. Undeterred in all circumstances, Manu's rule spread his glorious fame over the three lokas and beyond, even up to Satyaloka planetary system, the topmost in the universe. Okay. Dhanvantari avatar descended into the ever-diseased material world to introduce the Vedic science of medicine, Ayurveda. In fact, by the fame that is this alone, that is his alone, wherever he may go, he very quickly cures the diseases of the living entities. Right? Because disease comes from not being God conscious. Right? It means you don't follow God's laws. That means you're not conscious of God. Whether it's in its primary state as being conscious of the person, or secondary state being conscious of the laws of the Supreme, or just somehow or another having some general idea that you should do something that doing this is right, even if one doesn't have a higher background. Right? So then what does that do? That creates the disease. So disease comes from that. So wherever the Lord is, then the disease goes away. By his grace alone, the demigods achieve long lives. Thus the personality of Godhead, Dhanvantari, is ever glorified. To him a share of Vedic sacrifices must be offered. Long ago, the Kshatriya kings became very puffed up due to their opulence and power. They arrogantly turned their faces away from the Supreme Lord and spoiled their good names as world leaders simply for sense pleasure. The Lord descended into a Brahmana family to rectify this great offense to the Varnashrama civilization. Right, so that was just the catalyst, what he did to the Lord's father. But it's actually the mentality was wrong in the first place. Otherwise, then you would only have to kill that one king. Right? The Lila exhibited in this incarnation features him single-handedly making war against the degraded rulers and their excessive military forces. As a forest sage, he had only an axe for chopping firewood to take up in battle, but because of his unmatched prowess, he is known by the name as Parasu Rama. Parasu means axe. So he's one of the Ramas. You have Bala Rama, Parasu Rama, and Rama Chandra. Right. He's the three Ramas. So he's known as the Ram with the axe. Right. Fighting 21 campaigns against the Kshatriya class. Right, not just, you know, 21 battles, but 21 meaning when there's one group, means all the kings of the world, he fought that battle with them and killed them all. Then when the next generation comes up, right, and then they have amassed their armies, then he comes back for the next battle with all the kings on the planet. So he does that for 21 generations. That's serious. You know, and he does that simply with the axe that they use to cut firewood. So it's a smaller axe. It's a little, the Brahmins that carry these little ones, you know, that they use for cutting the, you know, the wood for the sacrifice and, you know, for cooking. Like that. You know, it's not for, you know, the big ones for chopping down trees and like that.
A head on just one side?
Yeah, head on one side. Yeah, so therefore, it's effective.
Yes.
Fighting 21 campaigns against the Kshatriya class, Lord Parasaram very nearly rid the earth of every last king and prince. A few were spared so that in time the royal order, purified and chastened by the severe schooling that Rama with axe gave them, was restored in society. Right, so, you know, in other words, if he had done it one time, they would have thought, well, that was a fluke, you know, or did it a few times, well, he was just lucky, or, yeah, they were too old, they were weak. No, but we can do it 21 times, 21 generations, and it's not just, you know, one king here and there, but it means all of them. So then at the end, he leaves a few that show some promise. And so there's a good chance that they'll kind of think, okay, maybe we should, you know, follow the rules that we're supposed to as Kshatriyas. And so it's said that even though it's Treta Yuga, it became a golden age like Satya Yuga during that period, that first ruling of Kshatriyas after Parasaram finished 21 tours. Right? So the 22nd generation, then it was. Brahma sings three verses, that was verse 22. Brahma sings three verses in praise of Lord Ramachandra, who descends into the royal dynasty of Ikshvaku with his plenary extensions, his three transcendental brothers. Lakshmi Devi, his internal potency, plays the role of his wife, Princess Sita. Ever loyal to his father, Maharaj Dasarath, Ramachandra even humbly consented to banishment to the forest for 12 years. The Lord was accompanied by Sita and his younger brother Lakshmana. Ten-headed Ravana, the powerful king of the man-eating Rakshasa, sought only to offend the Lord, even to the extent of kidnapping his wife and spiriting her off to his island domain, Lanka. The angry, red-hot glances cast by the Lord from the shore of Lanka Island seemed to boil the ocean. Its waves became violently agitated, and within those waves the great aquatics felt the burning of the Lord's fiery eyes. Srila Prabhupada comments, when Ramachandra was angry and showed his red-hot eyes, the whole ocean became heated with that energy, so much so that the aquatics within the great ocean felt the heat, and the personified ocean trembled in fear and offered the Lord an easy path for reaching the enemy's city. The impersonalist will see havoc in this red-hot sentiment of the Lord because they want to see negation in perfection. Because the Lord is absolute, the impersonalists imagine that in the absolute, the sentiment of anger, which resembles mundane sentiments, must be conspicuous by absence. It doesn't understand that there's original, right? Like that. Due to a poor fund of knowledge, they do not realize that the sentiment of the absolute person is transcendental to all mundane concepts of quality and quantity. Such sentiments are definitely not absent in the Supreme, as the impersonalists think, making their mundane estimation of the transcendental world. Because right? They don't know beyond the impersonal, so they actually don't have qualification to deal with the impersonal.
Srila Prabhupada had a similar point in the interpreter to the first verse of the Bhagavatam, but in relation to sex life, and because the impersonalists don't accept Krishna's sex life, they give stress to the mundane.
Yes. Yeah, so then they become distracted by there, because until you've gotten rid of the Purusha Bhav, then that will always be a problem. And so the ocean gave him free passage to Lanka. Ravana was powerful enough to defeat Indra, but with the hum of his powerful bowstring, the Lord laid the demon's body down.
Maharaj, about this Ramachandra's anger, that you don't see also how this is just like a pastime, that if he really was angry, he could just fix it, you know, destroy the whole universe, just heats up the ocean a little bit, gets a nice bridge, you know, like that.
The problem is they'll attribute that past times and all these needs are going on is because there's a mundane element, because they have no knowledge of spiritual qualities, because they think Brahman has no qualities. That's the difficulty. Right? Because the ones who will complain are not Brahmavadis, because Brahmavadis is all Brahman, so they're cool. The difficulty is the impersonalist in the form of Mayavadis. Because they think if there is form and activity and feelings, then there's illusion. So they attribute this illusion to the Lord. Right? So that's their problem. Is that they have no, because they're approaching the Supreme Absolute Truth only through intelligence, not with devotion, so they can't know Him as a person. That's what I said. The next 10 verses describe Lord Sri Krishna, the source of all avatars. Brahma begins the narrative of Krishna Lila by telling Narada that the kings of the world were at it again. Right, so this is the third time, right? Before he did it with the Sudarshan, then he did it with an axe, and now here's the third time. Poor Bhumi Devi, Mother Earth, could not bear the weight of the human populace because mankind's ruling class had descended into godlessness. To relieve Bhumi's distress, the all-attractive original form of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, known also as Keshava, because of the soft, fine black hair upon his head, descended from the spiritual sky along with his brother, Baladev. In Krishna Sandarbha, Anucheda 29, Srila Jiva Goswami comments at some length on verse 26, and verses from other sources that gloss the word Kesha with reference to the descent of Krishna and Balaram. For example, our critic may quote the following verse from the Vishnu Purana, 5.1.59. So this is Jiva Goswami. Uja harat mana keshav sita krishna mahamune. Our critic may interpret this verse to mean, O great sage, Lord Vishnu then plucked a white hair and a black hair from his own transcendental body, and these two hairs became his incarnations, known as Balaram and Krishna. Our critic may also quote the following verse from the Mahabharata. Lord Vishnu, Kiradakshaya Vishnu, snatched two hairs, one white and one black, from his head. These two hairs entered the wombs of Rohini and Devaki, members of the Yadu dynasty. Balaram was born of Rohini, Krishna was born of Devaki. Thus Balaram appeared from the first hair, and Krishna appeared from the second hair. A similar non-detailed statement is there in Srimad Bhagavatam 2.7.26, Sita Krishna Kesha. In his commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam 2.7.26, Sridhar Swami gives the proper explanation of these passages from the Vishnu Purana and Mahabharata. Sometimes in the Vedic literatures, Krishna and Balaram is described as white and black keshas. In this context, the word kesha does not mean hair, but is used in the sense of splendor. The phrase Sita Krishna Keshav means Balaram and Krishna who have beautiful white and black complexions. It does not mean that black and white hairs grew at a certain time on the head of the changeless, the Supreme Person. The Vishnu Purana explains, Ujahar Ratmana Keshav. This phrase means the forms as Balaram and Krishna relieve the burden of the earth. If one tries to interpret the word Kesha in these passages is hair, and contends that Balaram and Krishna are incarnations of two of Lord Vishnu's hairs,
He will contradict the clear statements of many verses in the Vedic literatures. And he will especially contradict the authoritative statement in the verse, Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam, in Srimad Bhagavatam 1.3.28. Even if one insists that the word Kesha must mean hair and cannot mean anything else, it is not at all necessary that one interpret that Krishna and Balarama are incarnations of Vishnu. One may also interpret that Vasudeva and Sankarshan are incarnations of a black and white hair from the head of Lord Krishna. Understood in this way, we may conceive of the following conversation between Lord Krishna and the demigods in order to properly understand these two quotes from the Vishnu Purana and Mahabharata. Lord Krishna may have said to the demigods, "My dear demigods, why do you ask me to personally appear in the material world? I do not need to personally come, but rather I shall send my expansions of Sankarshan and Vasudeva, who are like white and black hairs on my head. Sankarshan and Vasudeva will certainly fulfill your request by removing the burden of the earth. Even my two hairs can remove the burden of the earth. It is not a big job." 9. The Vaishnavas hold that in this pastime as described above, Krishna did not uproot, rather he lifted the two hairs, signifying Balaram and Krishna's appearance. Okay. Right, saying that even these two hairs can do it. Right, in other words, the Lord is all powerful, even with a hair he could do it. You know. And the fun part is the hair doesn't even have to leave his head. The statement Ujaharatmana Keshav is explained by Bhopadev Goswami in his commentary Muktafala Tika. The word Keshav consists of the two words Ka and Ishav. Ka means blissful, happiness, and Ishav means the two personalities of Godhead, because Ishav is plural. It's the plural case. Right? Two lords of happiness. In the phrase Sita Krishna Keshav, the word Sita is a name of Balarama. This phrase therefore means Balaram and Krishna, who are the two blissful personalities of Godhead. Right, so here's the other. So one is he's showing just by, if you're taking it from your use of the word Kesha simply to mean hair, right? Because there's always the element of working with the standard usage of a word as conventional, as opposed to going back to the root. But having now established the conventional, now we can go back to the root and show that it is in the same line. The interpretation that these words mean Balaram and Krishna are incarnations of two hairs of Lord Vishnu is not correct, for it is contradicted by the following explanation found in the Harivamsa. The next paragraph is about a pastime of Aniruddha, Kiridakshaya Vishnu. Thus, after instructing the demigods, the Supreme Personality of Godhead traveled on Garuda to a concealed mountain cave. In that cave, the Lord assumed his original form as Lord Krishna. Ordering Garuda to wait for him in that cave, the Lord then descended to earth in his original form. Footnote 10. From this verse is to be understood that Aniruddha and his non-different supersoul Vishnu aspect withdrew together into Prajumna, his non-different Garbhadakshaya Vishnu aspect, and in turn his Vyuha Murti Purusha Avatar aspect withdrew into Sankarshan. However, Sankarshan did not withdraw into Vasudeva. Why not? Because Sankarshan and Vasudeva are ever distinct in Krishna Lila. As Krishna stays in Braj only, but as Vasudeva leaves Braj with Balaram and Akrura. And Balaram stays in Braj only, but as Sankarshan, quote-unquote, leaves Braj with Sri Krishna and Akrura. Right? Because he never leaves, but at the same time, you know, he leaves. Because when he leaves, it's a different mood. So technically it's not Braj or Krishna. It's still Krishna, but not Krishna in the mood of Braj. So in Goloka, you only have Krishna. But Krishna in the mood of Braj, Krishna in the mood of Mathura, Krishna in the mood of Dwarka. Right? Like that. So in that way, Krishna in the mood of Braj never leaves Braj, but Krishna in the mood of Dwarka will leave Braj and go to Dwarka. So he's always there. That's what defines Goloka for what it is, because it's always Krishna. What to speak of the personality of Godhead, even the inferior demigods are free from the defects of old age. Because the personality of Godhead is always free from the symptoms of age, his hairs do not turn gray or white with age, as do those of a conditioned human being. The Vedic literatures always describe the hairs of the Supreme Lord as black. There's no description of white hairs. Hairs either naturally white or turned white with age in the spiritual body of the personality of Godhead. For this reason, the story of white and black hairs from the head of Lord Vishnu is not very plausible. The learned will not accept this,
because he only has black hairs on his head. We've only heard of a white hair on his chest, which is Lakshmi, right? But we've never heard of one on his head, right? Even if it's a natural white hair, but then it would be mentioned, right? They mention the white hair on his chest. Why wouldn't they mention the white hair on his head? It's not. So he's pointing out, so therefore the learned will not accept this as the definition.
Therefore, the statement of the Vishnu Purana, Ujjahar Atmana Keshav Sita Krishna Mahamune, should be understood in the following way. The word Atmana means from himself, and the word Keshav means the two incarnations, Vasudeva and Sankarshan, who have black and white complexions, and the word Ujjahara means manifested. The entire statement means the Lord then appeared as Vasudeva and Sankarshan, who have black and white complexions. He manifested two hairs to show he was manifested from these two personalities, Krishna and Balaram. Just as by seeing one face of the mountain, Sumeru, one can understand the nature of the entire mountain. In the same way, by properly understanding this verse from the Vishnu Purana, one will be able to know the actual nature of Lord Krishna's appearance in the material world. An explanation of the verses from Mahabharata quoted above is as follows. In these verses, the word Udvavarhe.
Oh, sorry, that's the time. After.
Okay.
So it's here.